And good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from Red River Radio. This program is produced with help from the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. We invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he's ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has had since 1997, and he's been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he has authored more than 80 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife Julie and their two children live in East Texas, and Cliff, welcome back for another show.
Oh, it's good to be in the air conditioning. I don't think anybody should be outside right now or right?
Not even the birds. I pity them out there, you know.
So they should huddle around the AC as well, right?
Absolutely. I hope they've adapted well, you know, to the heat around here.
Yeah, so. Exactly.
I know I haven't. So, well, folks, we are live on YouTube tonight. So if you want to watch Cliff do this show, you can check in to our Red River Radio YouTube camera. And in the meantime, we're going to get on with our show. So, Cliff, at the end of last month's program, you gave us a conservation tip. And as always, we're going to refresh everybody's memory about that. What was that tip?
Yeah.
And tell us all about it.
Last month, we ended the episode with a usual spot for conservation tips, something to think about, something to consider. And that topic last month was saving green space. We talked about how humans benefit from open space, and it also can benefit pocketbooks. We talked about how home prices near open space, like a park, can boost the home value. One study said 8 to 20%. Another study said 32% near a green belt. It's also open space is also a good place to have a quality of life that's just better. You've got more area for exercise, peace, solitude, bird watching, place for reflection and relaxation. So people are willing to pay more for this. So work with your city planners, your urban developers, and your government officials to increase parkland and other open space in your community, because it will also benefit birds. Birds need space too.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any call regarding our avian world is welcome.
You mentioned that we're on visibly live on YouTube. Is
that
right?
That's right, yes.
So I didn't know that. I've got to start tucking in my shirt, brushing my hair.
That would not be radio. There's a whole milieu about radio. We don't do any of that stuff.
I don't have any makeup on. If you look at those people on TV, they all look very polished and
right.
Anyway, so don't write in to say how we look, right? Just
there we go.
Listen in, and that's where the charm comes in.
There's a statement, a face made for radio, and yes, we have one. So at the beginning of every program, we do a profile species, Cliff. And what do you got for us this time?
Yeah, we're profiling one of my favorites tonight, the scissor-tailed flycatcher. And this makes our 47th species that we've profiled on this radio show. With its long, flowing tail feathers, this species is very recognizable by sight. But let's listen to their lively and boisterous vocalizations here. A lot of chattering. Couple individuals talking to one another.
Having a fight over food, I think.
Maybe. So the scissortail is the state bird of Oklahoma. Lucky them, because this is one beautiful bird. The body of a scissortail flycatcher is mostly a pale gray and white with a peachy side that sometimes is difficult to see. The most unique field mark, though, is the long black and white tail, which is longer in males than females and hatchier birds. As implied with a name like flycatcher, this is an insect eater that catches most of its prey on the wing. That's one reason why they sit conspicuously from a commanding perch of a power line, a fence row, or a high limb, so they can patrol the airways for anything tasty that's flying by. This flycatcher is feisty and related to kingbirds, which make them somewhat of the police of their field, pasture, or parking lot during the nesting season, often chasing off perceived threats like hawks and crows, but also lookalikes like soaring vultures. Known colloquially in the Lone Star State as the Texas Bird of Paradise, over two-thirds of the global breeding population of scissortails occurs in Texas. Over the last century, this species has slowly expanded its range northward and even eastward into Louisiana, where Harry Oberholzer, in his book called The Birdlife of Louisiana, lists this species as a rare spring and fall migrant and a casual summer visitor with no known breeding records at the time of that book's publication in 1938. When George Lowry wrote the 1974 edition of his book called Louisiana Birds, the scissortail had finally been found as a breeding species in numerous localities of the Bayou State. The first reliable nesting records for Louisiana about a half a century ago were from right here in the Shreveport area. In less than a month from now, scissortails gather at dusk in large pre-migratory roosts all across their range, often sharing those roost trees with their close cousin, the eastern kingbird. Remember, there's safety in numbers. Over the decades, and with a lot of luck, I've personally happened upon such pre-migratory roosts in early September in Nacogdoches, Henderson, and Crockett, Texas, where each hosted 100 to 200 scissortails. Watch for scissortail numbers to drop dramatically around Halloween in the Red River Radio listening area, with a few birds lingering into early November because most individuals have already headed south for the winter. Most scissortails winter from southern Mexico south to Panama, but a few overwinter in the Gulf Coast states, especially the closer you get to the coastline where average temperatures are milder and their food, aerial insects, are able to remain active later in the year, if not year-round. To see a photo of a scissortail flycatcher snapped by James Childress, please visit the Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We've had a number of pieces of audio and some photos that have been submitted, but we've got our first caller online, so we're going to put those on hold for right now. And we're going to go to Cheryl from El Dorado. Cheryl, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, Cliff. Thanks for taking my call.
Hey, great. Thanks for calling.
I'm watching you on YouTube. So. I'm so glad y'all are on tonight. I was cleaning off my front porch today, and there is a suspended little ceramic planter that a family of wrens nested in this spring. They fledged. They survived. And my question is, I've always taken wren nest out of ferns and other things, but is it better to leave this year's nest there? I don't know if it's the same pair or not, but I have a pair every year.
Right.
Or should I clean it out?
Yeah, I recommend to, once you're very sure that the birds are done nesting, mm-hmm. maybe give it a few days or weeks, I recommend cleaning it out. Very few birds the next year will reuse that nest, especially Carolina wren. They use already pretty rotten stuff that is going to really rot in our humidity as it's just sitting there, even if it doesn't get rained on under a porch or a patio. So clean it out. Because also another factor is in the breeding cycle of a pair of birds is there's a lot of pair bonding going on when they're building the nest. So we need to make sure that that's part of the equation too. So a clear open space is best, and clean it out. The bluebird folks are the best at this. Those that run bluebird trails with various boxes, they'll tell you to clean out the material at the end of the season and let the bluebirds 6-8 months later build new nests. So you've got a little homework assignment, and put it in your mulch pile. It's usually good stuff, and it'll be good mulch, and they'll find stuff for next year, Cheryl.
Well, good. And I do have a mulch pile. Thank you
good.
Very much.
Great. Thanks for the call.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. All lines are open right now, so you'll get right in. And in the meantime, yes, Cliff?
And I wanted to mention, while we're talking about removing nests, I'm not referring to each and every species nest. We're not taking down mockingbird nests and swallow nests and all that. I'm specifically talking about Carolina wren, or if you're in the range of Buick's wren. These are birds that, like Cheryl said, they'll build a nest in a planter, a fern, under a patio, in a shoe cubby, in an old boot is a great example. And so these are right next to our back porch, and so I'm talking specifically about those. So Don't think that I'm talking about going up in the tree and removing that giant red-tailed hawk nest. That's not what I'm talking about, okay?
All right, and there you go. You are listening to Bird Calls. We have lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. In the meantime, if you go to the Bird Calls website page for this show, we've got some images up there and also some audio that you can listen to at home as well as follow along with us. And the first one was sent by Roy Blake, and he's in Houston, and he submitted this image from downtown Houston. He writes, "Hello again. It's been a while since I sent you something, but isn't this a cool picture? Taken August 7th from the 27th floor of the building in downtown Houston. I'm presuming it's his office. His favorite nickname for this bird so far is Astro, and the folks there would like your help identifying it. They thought it was a Swainson hawk."
Yeah, and it's a red-tailed hawk.
Red-tailed hawk. It's a beautiful picture. If you get a chance, go to our website. This thing is right on the ledge of his office, it looks like, and it's looking right in the window. So it's like you get beautiful quality image.
And there are a lot of pictures of raptors that are on the edge of office buildings, and they can't see you. If the lighting is just right, that there's a glare. Everybody's done that. You've walked up to a window or a door, a glass door, and you walked in. You're like, oh, there's a party in here. I couldn't see anyone. Mm-hmm. So they're not seeing you, and they're seeing the reflection of what's behind them, the blue sky, the white clouds, themselves, et cetera. But what's neat about looking at those raptors, I always look at their feet, and you can see what they use to capture prey. And so a downtown red-tailed hawk is going to be after squirrels, pigeons, rats. There's going to be lots of prey items for them to eat. So it is a very cool picture, and thanks for sending that in.
Absolutely. I love to see that kind of quality and that up close look. Rarely you get up that close to a hawk, unless it's stuffed on a mantelpiece. So.
Right.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have all lines open right now, so please call in 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our avian world is welcome, and we hope to hear from you soon. In the meantime, we have some audio that was sent to us by Gregory Lloyd. And he says that he's from Alexandria, and he submitted this audio for us. He's heard this mournful call in the evenings for the last 2 years, July and August, and he was hoping that you could help him identify exactly what this is.
And you can hear just enough of that recording, even though it's probably done with a cell phone, that's usually okay. Right. And that bird is the Eastern screech owl, and we have a better recording here. Let's play that.
It reminds me of the warble of a loon.
A little bit like a yodel. And this is the whinny call of the Eastern screech owl. He's a little owl, about the size of a 12-ounce soda can, not a big bird. And that they're all over our listening area. They have a pretty large range in the U.S. too. The Eastern Screech Owl. So that's a really good recording that he sent in, and that's really neat that we could play that on air.
All right. And we have our next caller up. By the way, you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any call regarding our avian world and the birds is welcome. And right now we have Leon from Bossier City calling in. Leon, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, Cliff. The scissor-tailed flycatcher that you mentioned.
Yeah.
I was so interested in your description of it.
Okay.
I grew up south San Antonio in Atascosa County.
Uh-huh.
And there were some scissor-tails in that neck of the woods in the mid-50s.
Yep.
And I wonder is that an unusual population location?
No. When I meant they're expanding northward and eastward, I meant from Texas as a whole, especially south and central Texas. And so that would include where you were. So north meaning into Kansas and eastward into Louisiana and even across the Mississippi River, where back in your day you're talking about, they were definitely, the mother lode was right where you were. So it was not unusual there. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I misunderstood what you were saying.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Thanks, Leon.
Thanks for the info.
Uh-huh.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can get right in right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. I don't have a name yet, but we're going to go to our next caller online. And go ahead. You're on with Cliff. What's your name and where are you calling from? And what's your question?
Hi, my name is Kelly. I live in Houghton with a lot of woods around me and a lot of birds.
Houghton.
I live there.
Where is Houghton?
It's just Houghton. just east of here.
Okay.
Right down I-20.
All right. So what do you got?
I live in a wooded area, and there are lots of different birds. And I've lived there for a few years, and I've tried different types of bird seeds to try to attract different birds.
Uh-huh.
And I would like advice on, number one, the type of seed to buy.
Okay.
And number two, the best place to put my bird feeders.
Okay.
That's I do have cats outside.
Okay.
They rarely ever get a bird, but if there's a better place, I'd like to know.
Yeah. They rarely get a bird that you know of. I think there's a lot of people's cats that are more successful than we realize. But those are great questions, Kelly. I'm a proponent of this time of the year of switching to a bird bath and forget the seed. So it's not just the seed that you put in your feeder, it's when you do it. And the hot time of the year, there's so much food right now for birds. But what's lacking in my area, it hasn't rained a whole lot in the last 3-4 weeks. Plus, it's been about 105 degrees with the heat index. So puddles are dry. Creeks are drying. I drove over a couple rivers. They were really low. Get a bird bath, and you will get a lot of species coming to your bird bath. And
I do have a bird bath. And I, as a matter of fact, just last week, I noticed that I had let it get dry. And I saw a different birds. I don't know what it was. I wish I'd gotten a picture.
Yeah.
But it almost looked like it was panting. And I thought, oh my gosh, I got to get out there and fill my bird.
Yeah.
Birds.
Yeah. He was probably hot, and the bird bath is the best thing to do. So back to your feeder question, I would wait till it cools off, and that means October, November, and then I would go to black oil sunflower. That's the most easily found. It's not that expensive. If you think it's expensive, look at black thistle. That's probably one of the most expensive seeds for birds. So go with black oil sunflower, but wait till it's colder. Wait till birds really are needing extra food. And as the winter progresses and late into February, March is when sometimes when food is in the least amount, depending on where you are. And so they're kind of, a lot of birds are waiting for things to bud out in late February and March at our latitude. But again, I wouldn't be bothered by feeders this time of the year. And people that do feed right now, they'll call and tell us that, they get birds coming in, but I guarantee you they're not getting them in the frequency and the abundance as if they were doing it in January and February. So just focus on the bird bath, Kelly, and keep it wet and wash it out every few days, you know, with high pressure, and then refill it and keep it filled, and the birds will thank you for it, Kelly.
Great. And what about placement?
And the placement, yes, that's right. You did ask that. So for people that have cats or the neighbor's cats frequent your yard, you want to make sure your bird bath and your bird feeders are not right next to shrubbery, bushes, anywhere where a predator like a cat can sit, wait, and pounce on the bird. So let it have a few feet of leeway so the bird can flush, flee, and get away. So again, don't just put it right up against the bushes or right up against some big potted plant where something can hide behind it. Think about that. Make sure it has a buffer all the way around it of several feet. Okay?
Okay, good. That makes total sense.
Okay. Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any call or question regarding our avian world is welcome. And we go next to Bill from Greenwood. Bill, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, I'm calling about the Mississippi kite that I see flying in our area.
Okay.
I've heard people say that they eat insects on the wing.
Yes, that's correct.
And I wonder if you would talk about that and explain how that's at all possible, that they're catching a dragonfly or a moth on the wing. And the other thing I'd like you to comment on, if you can, is I sometimes see them flying together as if they're almost flying, like a pack of orca or a pack of wolves.
Uh-huh.
And I wonder if they're working together, if you think they're working together and herding these insects that are flying at that height.
Yeah,
and,
I don't. I see. That's a great question on the Mississippi kite. I've seen big groups getting off a roost I don't know, 30 minutes, 60 minutes after daylight. They don't get up first light usually.
Mm-hmm.
But especially in migration, I've seen 60-ish Mississippi kites fly off of a roost, and then they're all hitting the same thermal, and they're all working that same thermal, and it looks like they're maybe working together, but they just happen to sleep in the same La Quinta, and they just happen to get up when that first thermal heated the earth and created that updraft that they then hitch a ride on. So, but in the middle of the day, I have seen two or three Mississippi kites working together. I think the question is that we don't see those insects that are up there without optics. And
mm-hmm.
and so you can tell when a Mississippi kite is chasing something, because all of a sudden this lazy circling turns into a stoop and dive. And so then I have to assume it's caught something, and if I have binoculars, I will see it bring its foot up and grab the insect so it can take a bite. So they grab the insect with their foot, but they'll use their foot to break off chunks like the wings of a dragonfly that's not really edible. It's just not what they want to devour. They want that fleshy, juicy body. So I think if you start using optics, binoculars, mm-hmm. and follow those birds, you might end up seeing these insects in the air. And I don't think you're going to see this. It's not going to be like millions and millions of insects up there, because those birds are clearly wandering and waiting for the once or twice every few minutes that something comes into view. But they're also after cicadas. There's large grasshoppers. There's moths. There's a lot of stuff flying around up above the tree canopy that we just can't see with our naked eye.
Will you describe for me what they're doing, or what you say they're doing when they're diving at an insect? I don't think I've seen that. I thought they were grabbing them when they were, circling.
Well, so that's when, you know, like I said, there's just not hundreds and dozens of insects up there. So if that bird spots something 20 meters away below, it's going to fold its wings and dive after it. It's on a pursuit. It's an attack. And they're not just playing. They're grabbing food. And I know that, again, because you can see them work their feet. And if you don't have binoculars, you can't tell what he's doing with his feet and his beak. So he'll drop his head low and bring his foot up. And while flying all around the belly, breast area, he's going to be working on that food item, consuming it, breaking it up, et cetera. So if you use binoculars, you'll see this. And I would go with 10 power because this we're talking about little stuff at high at heights that are pretty high. And if you have sevens or eights, you might not see all this. But certainly the 7 or 8x binoculars is going to be better than nothing.
Thank you so much. Yeah. I really enjoy your show.
Great. Thank you, Bill.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, and we have all lines open now. You can get right in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. If you want to send us a photo, you can send it to my email address at wbeckett@lsus.edu. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu. In the meantime, we have some more stuff that was submitted before the show, and one of these is a feather that I submitted. Uh-huh. This was a feather. I took the picture outside my home, and it was just laying on the ground, but it's in pristine shape. So I thought I'd grab a photo of it and send that to Cliff. What is this?
Yeah, this is a flight feather of a mourning dove. And they're really easy to find because we've got a lot of mourning doves in our urban areas where people are. And these guys are molting. And so it's a nice gray, pretty plain gray feather. And it's a mourning dove. And yeah,
If you hear this outside your place in the morning, which I do often, then this is a mourning dove.
And remember its name, M-O-U-R, and mourning, mournful as in sad, maybe because he just lost its feather and he's really upset about it.
Could be, or the neighborhood cat might have gotten him, you never know. So.
Yeah.
And we also have some audio that was submitted by one of our listeners, Margaret Ferrazzi from Harris County, Texas, I believe. And we're just going to play one of these audio samples. She gave us three, and we're going to pop in one of these here real quick. She gave us three different birds.
Did we recognize her name? Did we tell who it was?
Margaret Ferrazzi.
Okay, you did say that. And Harris County's Houston.
Yeah.
And that's a house sparrow, and it's not very musical, and same note over and over, and most people probably tune that out, but those are all over our cities.
Right.
Very common. That's, the house sparrow.
Yeah, I hear that quite often in the morning around my place. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we got another call. Daryl from Mooringsport is on. Cliff, Daryl, what's your question?
Yeah, how do you protect your chickens from red-tailed hawks?
You put them in a coop.
Enclosed?
Yeah, you betcha. A coop has got all sides protected because that chicken tastes good, not just to red-tailed hawks, but your neighborhood foxes, bobcats, skunks, raccoons, neighborhood cats, dogs. I mean, everybody wants to eat a chicken, so you got to put them in a coop. Free-ranging chickens are vulnerable, and don't blame just birds because I'm listed a whole bunch of mammals, including domesticated ones, that are after that tasty meal. Don't make it easy on the predators. Put them in a coop.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Daryl.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, and we have all lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And in the meantime, you have gotten some questions about people thinking that they're seeing baby eagles.
Yeah.
And what is that all
about? I thought we'd talk about that a minute because when I get the same type of phone call several times, it's definitely worth mentioning. So people call thinking they're seeing baby bald eagles, and they call, and I talk to them, and I ask them to describe it, and they describe a bird much smaller than a bald eagle, but what they're going by is has a pale head, and it's clearly a raptor. And so they're actually describing a Mississippi kite, and that was what we talked about just a minute ago when Bill from Greenwood called about Mississippi kites. So the interesting thing is that when most birds have left their parents and they're no longer being tended to, and they've left the nest and they're on their own, they're as big as they're going to ever be for most species, including a bald eagle. So the thing about a baby bald eagle is he's as big as mom and dad, maybe not as heavy, but he also doesn't get that bald head until about his fifth or fifth and a half year. So if you think you're seeing a baby bald eagle, he's going to be all chocolate brown, and he's going to be huge. He's going to be the size of mom and dad if he's flying around, and this time of the year especially. There are no little baby bald eagles out there. So if you're seeing a smallish raptor out there with a white or pale gray head, and you're like these callers that are describing this bird, it's a Mississippi kite. It's a different raptor, and it's, I don't know. I don't think it looks like a baby bald eagle, but I don't see the same thing that everybody else does. So I thought we'd mention that if you're in that same camp, that you're looking at a Mississippi kite.
All right. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call now at 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. We have lines open right now, and we do have Ty from New Boston, Texas, with a question. Ty, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Yes, good afternoon, Cliff. My question is about Baltimore Orioles. I'm over here at the very east part of Texas, uh-huh. Northeast, uh-huh. And we have every species out here, sparrows, the redbirds, mockingbirds, blue jays, and many, many barn swallows, too. But okay. My question is, just last weekend, I saw a flutter or a squad, a bundle of Baltimore Orioles, and I know they're Orioles because they have the red chest on them. They're okay. Black. They're black on the ground. That as soon as they take off, you know what they are.
Okay, I would describe that as orange, and
okay,
not
okay,
red.
Orange, yes, sir.
So
yes, sir.
Okay, so hopefully we're talking about the same critter.
I think we are.
Yeah, I'm talking orange, like a naval orange.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, I just mixed up my colors.
Okay. And so what's the question about Baltimore Orioles?
My question is that I hadn't seen them out here recently in the past 2 years.
Uh-huh.
And then all of a sudden last weekend we're out for a walk, hiking actually, and then in an open field, I said, well, look at all them. My wife says those are crows. I said, no, those are Baltimore Orioles. She goes, but they're all black. And I said, well, wait till they take off. And they were feeding, you know, they do it in clumps and in groups. And then so they wouldn't go anywhere. And I thought, well, we were just about at the end of the pasture. So I clapped my hand. And when I did, they took off. And she goes, yes. Look, yeah, they do have an orange patch on their breast. And I was just wondering, are they just coming over here just to eat for a little bit? Because like I said earlier, I seen them 2 years ago, and last year I had not seen not a one. And then this year I got to see them again.
Right.
And it was just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful bird to watch in flight.
All right, Ty, I don't know if you're going to like this, but I think we've got a misidentification. You said several things that have pointed to red-winged blackbird. When your wife said it was all dark, and when you said earlier it had red on it, and then you said a pasture, none of that points to a Baltimore Oriole. Baltimore Orioles are up in the trees. There's never an angle that you can't see orange. I bet 50% of the bird is orange, naval orange.
Okay.
So I think you're seeing red-winged blackbirds. And and there's nothing wrong with misidentifying a bird. You got it to the right family, because orioles and blackbirds are related. So, but yeah, I think those are male red-winged blackbirds.
Good deal.
Yeah.
Hey, I like to be wrong.
Hey, all right. Well,
I like to be wrong.
I like that you're happy about it, because I don't like upsetting people. But
no, sir.
But all the evidence points to red-winged blackbirds.
Very good.
Yeah.
Very good.
All right.
Okay, I love your program. Thank you all
awesome.
So much.
Thank you, Ty.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Ty. And are Baltimore Orioles corvids then? Or,
no.
But they're part of a broader family?
No, corvids are ravens, jays, magpies.
But not red-winged blackbirds.
No, they're icterids. Those are your blackbirds, grackles, cowbirds, orioles, etc.
Okay.
So the oriole and the red-winged blackbird are in the same family, but corvids are going to be your blue jay, your American crow, your black-billed magpie out in the Rocky Mountains, etc.
Well, that's interesting that a blue jay would be in that family.
Yeah, he's a jay, he's an he's a corvid, and there's you know, those corvids are thought to be big thinkers, problem solvers in the lab setting. They've studied ravens and crows and jays that can figure things out, how to get food that most birds would be just, you know, banging their head against a wall. Jays and crows figure things out. So smart birds. Maybe I'll come back in a second life as a corvid. How about that?
Interesting. Sounds like they're the ancestors of, or the offspring or prodigy of velociraptors, you know? So
maybe.
Yeah, there
maybe
you go.
So.
Smart
yeah.
birds.
Yeah.
That's dangerous.
Right.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we have most of the lines open right now, but please stay with us. We're going to go next to May from Lake of the Pines. May, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Cliff, can you settle once and for all on black-chinned hummingbirds in East Texas? Because we're in a big Facebook debate about that.
Yeah, and here's what I tell people. If you don't see the purple that's at the bottom of the gorget, the bottom of that throat patch, you're not seeing a black-chinned hummingbird. And most, I would say 99.9% of the hummingbirds that we're going to see are not black-chinned hummingbirds. They're ruby-throateds at a funny angle. We call that blacked out. And if people pay attention and watch and move around, that blacked-out ruby throat will eventually show some of the red. It's at certain angles it can look kind of orangey or topaz, but never purple. And a black chin, that purple never has a different color. It never looks reddish or golden or yellow or anything else. It's purple. So I don't think people in your area are going to see a black chin hummingbird, but birds have wings. They can show up anywhere. But those folks that claim they have a black chin, they've got to see the purple. They got to take a picture of the purple. And just seeing that blackout, it is not good enough, because all ruby throats at a profile especially look blacked out, and thus people think black-chinned.
Okay, excellent.
Yeah.
Thank you for your thank you for the info.
And so all that is iridescence. It's the it's the playing of light, it's the tricks of light. And so what people don't realize is that just seeing flat black, it tells you that it's probably a black chinned or a ruby throat, but that gets you to genus. That doesn't get you to species. And so in Texas, you got to figure out which one it is. And the farther east you go into Louisiana, black chin gets even harder to find. But you've got to be near the I-35 corridor and west of before you pick up a lot of black chinned hummingbirds. And they typically leave a good 4 weeks before ruby-throated hummingbirds. So most of our black chins should be going, gone right now, whereas ruby throats are still a month away from really picking up in numbers. So that's a lot of rambling, May, but
I appreciate it.
Yeah, so to solve your Facebook dilemma or whatever it was, they're not seeing black chins until they can prove otherwise, and the only way to prove it is to see and photograph the purple that's only on the bottom half of that gorget. Okay? Very good.
Thank you so much, sir.
Great topic. I love hummingbirds.
All right. Yeah, okay. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have lines open right now, and we're going to go next. Ken from Shreveport, please hang on the line, and Larry from Shreveport as well, because we've got Fred up next. Fred from Wascom, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
I have a question about an exotic bird. Do you know anything about exotic birds?
Are those the ones that get up on stage and dance around? And
this one's pretty sharp. She might do it. My wife has a blue front parrot.
Okay.
And it's a female, but it usually bonds with a male.
Uh-huh.
But it hates me, and it loves her.
Right.
Do you have any suggestion about what I can do to endear myself to that bird?
Yeah,
that bites me all the time. And
this is not uncommon for people that own parrots that pair bond, not necessarily with a sex, but with an individual. So it might like other females, but it's pretty much bonded with your wife, and you're a perceived third party outsider. And I don't think you're going to overcome that. I think
that was what I was thinking.
Yeah.
That she is territorial.
Yeah.
And she thinks my wife is her buddy or mate or whatever. And whenever I threaten that, it's when she gets on me. Am I right about that?
Yeah, you just have to live with it, because otherwise you're going to have to get rid of the wife or the parrot, and I wouldn't do either of those. So live in harmony. Just keep your finger away, because you've seen what that parrot can do with that bill, right?
Exactly. I was hoping you could help me, but anyway.
No, there's nothing to do. And so have you tested have you had blood work done on that bird to know that it is a female? Because you can't look at them and tell. You got to do DNA work or blood work.
I'll have to say no. She hasn't been sexed, but she's laid an egg.
Oh, okay. Well, then it is. Okay. That's definitely a female. And they just, you know, that's the one thing about certain birds not being good in captivity. A single parrot is usually it's really rough on them, and so to compensate, they're being social, they'll pair bond with a human. But the best thing to do is have a buddy for that parrot, but you know, a human like your wife is a good alternative. But the problem is some of these parrots, and especially macaws, outlive us. And so if you get a parrot late in life and it's young and you're old, guess what? You're going to be handing it down to your kids. And if it's a macaw, it might even get handed down to their kids. So, I think for most part, parrots are just best out in nature. They're really cool to see. But I understand, you know, I've owned them before only as rescues. I've never bought one. But I've had a few over the years that were rescues, and they do bond. And I think, Fred, you're just going to have to just keep your distance and realize that your wife has a boyfriend.
That's right.
All right.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thanks, Fred.
Well, as they say, if she feeds them, then that bird will love her. So there you go. It's all about the food. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have several calls waiting online. Larry and Bernard, please stay on the line right now, because we've got Ken from Shreveport is next. Ken, what's your question?
My question is different. I'm recently appointed the person who invites guest speakers for the Broadmoor Neighborhood Association. I was president 13 years, and currently I'm looking for guest speakers, and I've asked several members, and they all agree that Cliff would be an excellent guest speaker. We cannot pay cash, but we can give you a nice gift card, and we meet on the third Thursday. So I'd like to give my information off the air, if you can perhaps come one evening and do a presentation and answer calls from Broadmoor residents who love birds.
Right.
We have hummingbird feeders all over Broadmoor.
Yeah. I appreciate the invitation, Ken. And I'm going to, you know, I travel enough with my day job, and yeah. traveling over here, you know, it's about 98 oh. miles door to door. So I'm going to have to decline on the air because I don't want this to be a precedence because I get hit up a lot. Yeah.
Other people would invite you.
Yeah, and okay. I tell people no, and I appreciate it, but I am just booked and overbooked, and I have to stay in Texas for the most part. When I do my outreach, I have
all right,
to.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right.
Thanks,
take
Ken.
Care.
Sorry.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Bernard, please hang on the line from Lufkin because Larry from Shreveport is next. Larry, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
My question is there an easy way to distinguish the Baltimore Oriole from the Orchard Oriole?
Yes, by both sight and sound. They're very different. The only thing they share in common is the second half of their name, Oriole. So by sight, the males especially are extremely different. The male Baltimore has orange and black. The male Orchard is a chestnut and black. Now, the females can look pretty similar, but the female Baltimore Oriole, it has an orangey tinge. She's a little larger than the slightly smaller and yellowier Orchard Oriole female, and then the songs are very different. So I think if you're getting them confused, it'd be just the females. And once you start seeing that difference in yellowy versus orange-yellow, then you'll see that they're different birds altogether.
So if you have that brilliant orange, it's the Baltimore.
Yeah, and there's, you know, depends on where you're calling from. There's a close relative called the Bullock's Oriole that's kind of the western U.S. counterpart to the Baltimore Oriole, and it's also orange. But if you're in our Red River listing area and you see something bright orange with some black, then it is probably a Baltimore Oriole.
Okay.
Yeah.
The illustrations and some of the guides are not that different.
Yeah, in the females, but in the males, my gosh, they're different. There's no contest between that navel orange of a Baltimore Oriole and that cherry oak wood color of almost burgundy of the Orchard Oriole.
Okay.
So very different.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call now, 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. All but one line are open, so you'll get in fairly quickly. And we have one caller left, and that is Bernard from Lufkin. Bernard, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Yeah, hi, Cliff. The previous caller actually pretty much dealt with what I was going to talk about or ask about, which is to do with Orioles. And
okay.
To keep pushing that too much, but I live in Lufkin in East Texas, and I get a lot of Orchard Orioles around here.
Right.
And they have a beautiful song, too, as well as the appearance that you were just discussing.
Mm-hmm.
But people talk a lot about Baltimore Orioles, but I've never seen one around here. Do you get them in East Texas much?
Yeah, in Lufkin, they'll be pouring through in the fall, and that's going to start in the next couple weeks, maybe. They'll start picking up in numbers any day, actually, in the next week or two, I think, and into September and maybe a little into October. And a lot of people will see them. They'll come to bird baths. And so if you're lucky enough, you'll have one pour through or you know, head through your neighborhood. Maybe you'll see it. But that bright orange and black is unmistakable. And it, to me, looks, when it's flying, looks like some exotic butterfly because it's so much bright orange and black on it. So, yeah, look for it in fall migration. And if you miss it this fall, they come back in the springtime and they'll come through our area. But they're a very rare and local nester in East Texas, and mostly a migrant through either fall or in spring.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Thanks. I'll keep an eye out for them.
Okay, thanks, Bernard.
The Orchard Oriole, are they here? What
yeah.
time of year?
And the Orchard Orioles, they start arriving in spring, and they stick with us for a while, and they're going to be also southbound. They're one of our first land birds that really start to push south in July. You'll start seeing them in places where they haven't been because these are already migrants. But you could see definitely an orchard oriole any day right now if you get out and are lucky to spot one. So both are forested birds. So if you're out in a cattle pasture, you're going to have a hard time finding an oriole. So hit the woods.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for that.
Thanks, Bernard.
Bye.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. All lines are open right now. We have a few minutes left in our show, so you'll get right in. In the meantime, we did have a submitted question, and that is very simply, can baby eagles sometimes be confused for caracara when seen?
Well, again, baby eagles, and you know, that's not the correct word, and I use it all the time, but immature eagles don't get the white head till they're 5 years old, and that makes them mature or an adult. So I think there are a lot of caracaras that get misidentified as eagles, but if you watch a caracara, it's also got white in towards the tip of their wing, a little white patch near the tip of the wing, and there's also white in the tail that's different than a bald eagle. And then the white head is not, it's not a complete white head. So there's a big difference in that. So there are caracaras, I think, that get misidentified. The colloquial name for the caracara is Mexican eagle. And so you'll hear a lot of people say they had a Mexican eagle, and you're thinking, well, what is that? And chances are high that they're talking about a caracara. And so that's an interesting question for sure. So,
all right. And we're waiting for other calls. So if you've got a question, please call in 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. In the meantime, we have some submitted questions. And one of those is, should nature enthusiasts be concerned about the wild hogs increasing in our landscape?
Oh, emphatic yes. In fact, let me check my notes here. We covered that as a conservation tip.
Mm-hmm.
And for people that like to go back to our archives and listen to old shows, which you can do by going to our website, you will find that the wild hog, and I can't find it in my scant notes. Just give me a second here. We did cover it. And where is it? It's a huge issue. And so it would be great for anyone asking to go back. Here it is, January 2017 show. Our show in January of 2017, our conservation tip was feral hog. So all you have to do is find the show, January 2017, go to the last 3 or 4 minutes, and you'll hear what we have to say about feral hogs. But in one word, yes, we should all be concerned, not just nature enthusiasts, but the agriculture people are very upset with wild hogs because of the damage they do to crops. Motor vehicle operators are very upset with wild hogs because guess what? They cross roads, they're low, and when we hit them, they really damage our vehicles. So there's a lot of damage to crops and to vehicles and then to the environment as a whole. They're eating everything that they can reach. And, you know, birds nesting on the ground, snakes, just about anything. They're also competing with deer. So deer hunters, you know, if you like your deer or turkey hunters too, when acorns drop in the fall, the pigs are out there eating what is intended for turkeys, blue jays, white-tailed deer, red-headed woodpeckers, etc. So wild hogs are here to stay, but they should be controlled, and we did talk about that too, and we've talked about that in past shows. But it's we could spend an hour on that topic. So hopefully people can go back to January 2017 and hear more about it.
Now, is it primarily that they are affecting ground-dwelling birds, or are they affecting just any bird that may need its sustenance from that ground layer?
Well, they're also rooting up the saplings of future trees. So they can be rooting up little guys that are one day going to be giant stately trees. So they might not be affecting big trees now, but they're certainly affecting the next generation. So, yeah, they're bad just all the way around. And the nice thing is they taste good. So I encourage people to get out there and do their deed of controlling hog numbers and also putting food on the table with that cat, that hog that they've shot.
All right. And as always, we close our program each month with a conservation tip. And what do you have for us this time?
Tonight, we're going to talk about co-locating infrastructure, including various utilities. And I realize this is a small audience, but it's something for everyone to think about. So let's go. Habitat fragmentation is one of the most common and fastest ways to lose wildlife habitat. Land fragmentation, which we've covered before on this show, is the carving up of large blocks of habitat into smaller ones. When planning infrastructure on your property, whether you own that property or if you work in a field where you are impacting land, consider trying to co-locate new infrastructure that requires the clearing of land. For instance, new power lines or pipelines could parallel existing roads or go into existing easements instead of carving a separate path elsewhere that would involve the removal of existing blocks of forests, grasslands, and so forth. And when it comes to wetlands, avoid putting power lines over wetlands or constructing new wetlands under existing power lines because water birds striking those power lines will be impossible to avoid. In my state, Texas, where the human population is over 28 million people and is expected to double within the next 3 or 4 decades, all those new people will require additional roads, power lines, pipelines, towers, and more. The best thing to do is plan ahead by co-locating utilities and other infrastructure on your lands. This includes those people working in the fields of public utilities and environmental consulting, since they make a lot of the decisions of where such infrastructure will be placed. Consider co-location in order to save precious wildlife habitat from further fragmentation. Do it for the birds.
All right. And Leon, I know you're on hold right now. Unfortunately, we are not going to be able to get to your final question as it came in a little too late tonight. But Cliff, as always, I want to thank you again for joining us
great.
For and another edition of Bird Calls.
Thanks to you, Bill, for your help, too.
You bet. You have been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio and the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And we'd like to thank everybody at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help with this program. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. This has been Bird Calls from Red River Radio. I'm your producer, Bill Beckett, along with Cliff Shackelford, and our phone bank volunteers tonight were Renee Moran, Sheila Lawrence, and Susan Bettinger. And the sound files used in tonight's programs for our profile species were from xenocanto.org and were recorded by Andrew Spencer. This month's bird photo on our Bird Calls page was snapped by James Childress. The audio from tonight's program will be posted to our website in the next few hours, and you can listen to this program again on the website, redriverradio.org. And remember, if you have a photo or a sound clip of a bird and you'd like us to identify it, you can send it to my email address at wbeckett@lsus.edu. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu. Be sure to join us for the next installment of Bird Calls next month on a different date, Tuesday, September 24th. Due to a rare shuffling of our Red River Radio show schedule, we will be on 2 weeks later than normal. Next Tuesday night, we have What's Bugging You, and we hope you'll all tune in for that. This has been Bird Calls from Red River Radio. Stay tuned. Radio Lab is coming up next here on Red River Radio.